Hello, and you're very welcome to the second of our two special programmes celebrating the work and the spirit of our friend Sean Rocks. I'm Kieran Hines. In making these two programmes and listening back to Sean's work, it has been a bittersweet experience. Sean's loss is immense, but spending time with his work and hearing him in full flow with these artists has been fascinating and kind of joyous. And for me, as an old friend of his, it's particularly interesting because I've been interviewed by Sean a couple of times, and to me it always just felt like a conversation. He made you feel so much at ease, so warm. There was never any pressure to perform. And in the months since he died, so many people talked about his remarkable warmth and energy on air, and his innate ability to listen and bring out the best in people. So we're going to begin now with Sean's interview with the Oscar-winning film director Danny Boyle, both of whose parents hail from the west of Ireland. Some of Danny's films, like Trainspotting and 28 Days Later, are considered modern classics, but his talents go beyond the screen, with exceptional work as a theatre director, culminating perhaps in the opening ceremony of the London Olympics in 2012, which he devised and directed. And in June of this year, Sean spoke to Danny about his latest film, 28 Years Later, which is the third instalment in his post-apocalyptic trilogy.
Danny Boyle, you're very welcome to Arena. You might start by explaining to those who haven't seen the film, this community on Holy Island, in Lindisfarne for most of us, really, isn't it?
It is, really is. Yeah. And where Christianity first arrived, apparently. Yes, it's the perfect solution to the problem that the first film, 28 Days Later, set up, which is the infection riddled everywhere across the UK mainland. Mm. So how do you protect yourself if you have survived? And they're living on Holy Island, Lindisfarne, which is a causeway island, protected by the tide, unless the tide recedes, and therefore they built barrier gates to protect them at those times as well. And they've established a community of about 100, 150 people. And apparently, I never knew this, that is the perfect size of a community because you can trust everybody on personal experience. If you go bigger than that, you need a system to trust through, like money or religion. And so they've got this perfect... It's subsistence farming, so it's a bit, it's tough,
yeah.
But it's a kind of like a precious land, they call it. And our film begins when a father takes his son in the blooding rites over to the mainland in order to that he can experience killing infected.
One of the things that really struck me about that small island, a small community, there's a causeway across that people can come across on, but they don't want anybody coming near. They're a perfectly formed community. Brexit obviously fed into this in some way.
I know, you can read it like that, can't you? And you can't help but think about it, because it's happened. Since we made the first film, we've had two huge public incidents, if you like. One, COVID, you know, which damaged people in terrible personal ways. So many people were lost through it. And we went through an extraordinary experience, slightly reminiscent of the first film, in a way that the cities were emptied in that overnight, astonishingly overnight way they were transformed. But also we've been through something very damaging as well, which is Brexit, by which we've turned our back on our European peers and gone alone, for all sorts of insane reasons. I'm delighted to say I have an Irish passport, so I'm immune to some of the embarrassments of it. But the French do look at us now, and like, they're so tired. There's so much history with us of being a real pain in the neck, and we're being a pain in the neck again. But yes, you can't help but think it. Horror's lovely because you can put these transparencies of politics across it. It doesn't become a political film, but you can see things through it like that.
I have to say, too, I couldn't help but notice, I think it is in the schoolhouse or one of the houses on Holy Island, I can't remember which now, there's a portrait of Queen Elizabeth II in the back. And this gives us a sense of their values. They also have bows and arrows. You put in scenes, I think, from Olivia's Henry V.
Indeed, well spotted.
The longbowmen.
The longbowmen.
Yeah, all of that, it harks to a kind of a sense of these people harking back to an old England or an old Britain.
And when England especially was great and can be great again, it's got that sense about it. But they're looking back to Agincourt, which is like the 14th century. It's like it's a long way back. But yes, Henry V, St. Crispin's Day speech, we England, we few, we band of brothers. They're living in the past. And that boy, at the end, comes under the influence of his father, who wants him very much to follow in his footsteps. But he also comes under the influence of his mother, whose influence is much more subtle and leads to his final decision about his own future.
I have to say, though, when I saw the portrait of the Queen, I did think, was there a little side of you, first of all, paying her some respect and also remembering that great moment when she was part of the Olympic opening ceremony in London 2012?
Well, it was funny. It's funny because, of course, the truth is it's a practical decision. Because, of course, if you say life stopped, communication stopped for them 28 years ago. She was still on the throne, and they would assume, like George Bush after 9/11, that she would have been emergencied out to safety and was presumably living in Belgium or somewhere, you know, fondly dreaming of one day when she might return. So they haven't heard any of the news. And they wouldn't have heard about the Olympic ceremony either, which wouldn't have happened anyway. So,
no, I thought it might have been your little homage to her more than anything else. So the Holy Island is off the mainland. The mainland is a dangerous place, which makes me wonder, why is Aaron Taylor Johnson's character bringing his son Spike to this island? As you said, Jodie Comer playing the mother, not really wanting that to happen.
No, she doesn't. It's interesting. COVID is the key to that. When COVID happened, we all went super ultra safety, masks, gloves, disinfecting things, all that kind of stuff. But you can't keep that up for very long. And in fact, we all did gradually take more and more risks. You weren't assured of your safety, but because we didn't know enough about it, but we still took more and more risks. Yeah. And eventually you went back on the underground and took the mask off and things like that. So after 28 years, they would take significant risks because they knew they could try and keep themselves safe within those risks. So taking his son, although his mother objects, the rest of the population of the island are like,
yeah, this is great.
On you go.
Big party when he gets back.
Yeah, if you come back, there's a big party for you. There's an incentive to do it safely. Yeah.
I love the Ralph Fiennes character as well.
His name, Kelsey, fantastic.
Nods to The Tempest briefly.
Oh, yes. There's a bit of Tempest, bit of Kurtz in there from Apocalypse Now. Yeah, there's lots of references like that, yeah.
Do you know the words, memento mori?
No.
It means remember death. Remember you must die.
And there's the immigration theme started kicking in with me when that happened.
That's another of the transparencies you can read into it. Horror's great for that. Romero, who started the whole zombie genre, if you like, he would place kind of class politics, racism, Cold War, commercialism. They'd be transparencies he'd allow to pass through his films. And you read them differently. It depends on the era. It depends what's in the news. You can read Gaza in it. You can see that, you know, in terms of suffering and an attitude to people. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was looking at an interview you gave, and it's lovely when people quote you from 25 years ago, isn't it? But it's something you said around the time of 28 Days Later, where you talked about, this is about how we as humans treat each other, how we are pretty awful to each other. And I wondered, how different do you think it is now?
I think it's got worse. It's got worse, hasn't it? There's an intolerance, which is the sort of idea of the rage virus. There's an intolerance of each other, which, if anything, has grown. And I blame these things, our phones.
You're taking out your phone?
Yeah, because they're incredibly powerful, and they give us a feeling of power, and yet we're not powerful.
Let me ask you two quick things to end. I did notice, we always talk, you talk about the UK in the film a lot, but when the infected area is put up, the UK and the Republic of Ireland are in red. Are the people of Ballinasloe and your mother's hometown going to give you hell about that?
Well, it's obviously a ripe opportunity. If enough people go and see the film in Ireland this weekend, it's a ripe opportunity to suggest a sequel might be set in Dublin First City.
Yeah, and Cillian Murphy might be in it. Yeah.
Well, Cillian will definitely be in the third film. We're planning three films altogether. He actually is in the second film, and he's a producer on this first film.
Don't. Don't look at what's in front of you. Boost, 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 boost. Moving up and down again. Men, 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 men. Men go mad with watching them. There's no discharge in the war.
Well, finish with what was the trailer, because you say things have got worse. Boots, 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 and it's within the film as well, yes. Used very effectively within the film.
Brilliant. I know the Rudyard Kipling poem. Yeah. Who would have thought? And it was great for us because it allowed us to give that sense of the past, and yet it's compelling, compulsive, horrific, damaging in a way somehow, and make for a great trailer. It has nothing to do with me, the trailer. I have to be honest, that was Sony. They won 3 awards with it already.
Well, is it the beginning of awards for 28 years later?
I don't know about that.
Danny, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight.
Magic, thanks very much. Lovely to talk to you.
That was Danny Boyle speaking to Sean about his latest film. Now we're going to stick with a big screen. And in July, Sean spoke to Helena Bonham Carter, or HBC, as some of us know her, about her work in the adaptation of Niall Williams' 1997 novel, Four Letters of Love. Helena stars in the film alongside a few notable Irish actors you may or may not have heard of. But let Mr. Rocks take it from here.
What a joyous thing to get to do as a job. Jump into bed with Gabriel Byrne and have a nice little party with him.
And get paid for it. I had my hot water bottles too, so I was really comfortable and I had my snacks. It is, you know, it is an absurdly fun and lucky job we have. And it was fun also. I mean, Gabriel, I had 3 weeks in with a man. He talks nonstop. It's all good chat. And in fact, most of Ireland talks, doesn't it? I mean, I love Ireland. It was just like, oh my God, you're all extroverts. And I had such fun chats. Everyone's so warm.
We do talk. I think we do talk pretty well, I hope. You also had Pierce Brosnan there. Now, I know you didn't have, in terms of the film, you clearly wouldn't have had, I think you've little or no reaction with Pierce Brosnan's character. But I believe on the day you met the two of them, you were actually quite starstruck.
I know, my knees went, genuinely. I was like, oh God, I didn't think of this. Because, of course, when I was younger, they were like massive. I mean, they still are stars, but it was like, oh my God, I had crushes on them when I was younger. And it was like suddenly with them both in the trailer, I just was like, I can't meet them. And I just went, oh no, please, please. And then Polly pushed me in. But I was completely starstruck. And they're both really good looking and charming. So it's like, oh no. Anyway, I didn't really say much then, but I made up for it for the rest of the week.
Yeah. And the book itself then, on which the film is based, Helena, I think you have a long relationship with this book.
I love that book. It's like, I envy anyone who hasn't read it, who's going to read it. It's like they're in for a total beautiful and blissful adventure. I fell in love with it about 25 years ago. I read it. My mum gave me it. She'd read everything. She reads everything in the world. So this is the most special thing. And then it became my all-time favourite. And I wanted to try and get the rights and play Isabel. I would have been a slightly aged, I don't know, but I did look younger for my age then. And then nothing happened. Stanley Tucci bought it. Lots of people bought it and tried. But it's kind of an impossible thing to adapt until now.
Yeah, and it was Niall Williams himself who adapted it.
Yeah, beautiful script. It was like, you can't, it's just like most screenplays are quite dry, and this is poetry. And I just thought, the man's incapable of writing a normal sentence, you know, or a dull sentence or an unbeautiful one. It was a beautiful thing. And I thought, oh my God, this is like so much of the thing that the book itself is about, a predestiny and a fate and something that is a pattern that already is, you know, is there to be found and recognised. And I thought, oh, I just now, this is, that's all coming out of the book and enthralling me into being part of it.
you were delighted when the call came. You play the character of Margaret Gore. Now you're at the point where you can play the mother. Isabel Gore, played by Anne Skelly, is one of the parts that was the part that when you first read the book you thought might be a runner for you at that point. Let's listen to a scene where, in fact, Margaret is giving Isabel some advice on how to make marriage work.
Right. I want you to listen to me.
and say nothing. When I met him, when he fell for me, your father, he said the poems wrote themselves. They poured out of him. And I took that as a sign. But when they start, that would have to be a sign too. I thought that love was poetry and moonlight. It's not. Falling in love. Well, that's the easy part. The hard part is what follows. You have to make a marriage. The fact is, wives, they create their husbands. They begin with a blundering and well-meaning, sometimes charming, sometimes irresistible handsomeness they have fallen in love with, and that is fine. But then begins the work. That work is years long. Years. Years. In my case, 36 years and counting. Years of hard labor to make the man I could live with.
Helena Bonham Carter there as Margaret Gore in Four Letters of Love. She's with me on the programme this evening. Years of hard labour to make the man I could live with. Do you agree with her when she gives that advice?
36 years. 37 years. Well, yeah, there has a lot to be said for training somebody up, you know, making sure they put things away, don't, you know, leave the rubbish everywhere. Yeah, living with somebody is difficult. Mm. You might love them, but they can be, as oneself can be, basically antisocial at times. So one's got to bring an awareness of how to live with and love at the same time. It can be a tricky one.
Yeah. And it did also strike me, it's probably a few more years of hard labour to achieve the career that you have achieved and how difficult that is. We talked about Pierce Brosnan and Gabriel Byrne earlier on, who are still there working at full tilt, it would seem. Is it more difficult for a woman, do you think, to achieve that kind of longevity in her career? And how have you done it?
It's quite interesting. Yeah, I think there's more ageism with women, and there's more like, what do you look like? And that people are more less forgiving about women and age rather than with men. As sexual beings, I'd say. But I think that times are changing. I think with me, I've been drawn to character parts anyway, so I've sort of left off the hook a bit. So I wasn't that drawn to doing ingenues. I was relieved, really relieved, when I didn't have to play them anymore.
You'll forgive me, though, for mentioning the ingenue of them all, Lucy Honeychurch in Room With a View, because it did strike me that, if you like, Anne Skelly, who plays the part of Isabel, the young ingenue in Four Letters of Love, there are parallels, albeit very, very different worlds, you know, Italy and the travelling English, whereas here we have Ireland and the West Coast. But there are parallels there. Did you talk to Anne about that?
No. No, we didn't. We talked about the fact that Isabel, in a way, was the young Margaret before she all had her wildness and spontaneity stamped out of her by the sheer hard grind of her life. But there's definitely a kindred spirit, those two.
That was the wonderful Helena Bonham Carter there, speaking to her late friend Sean Rocks on Arena last summer. To music now, and in February, Sean welcomed the legendary American singer Candy Staten. As was always the case when Sean was asking the questions, there was a warm rapport between presenter and guest. As we'll hear, the conversation goes from Candy's new album, Back to My Roots, to her childhood in Alabama, and to the difficult, very personal story behind her timeless hit, Young Hearts Run Free.
Candy, you're most welcome, and thank you so much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean.
Listen, this album of yours, when I saw this title, Back to My Roots, I wondered, how is Candy Staten going to go back to her roots? How is she going to go about that? And you really do bring us back, I think, to the songs of your childhood, particularly the gospel music of your childhood in your family home. How big a thing was it in the Staten household, gospel music and Christianity?
I was big. My mother was a devout Christian woman of God, and she read us the Bible. We didn't have street lights and anything like that. Born and raised in Alabama, I stayed there until I was 11. Went to Cleveland. And that's when I got with the Jewel Tree. But every evening, she would sat there on the porch and she would read us the Bible and she would make us sit and listen. And then she would make us sing, "It's Gonna Rain."
Well, in fact, I was going to say, not only did she make you listen to the Bible, then she said, "You're finished listening now. Now get up there and sing that song." Let us listen to how you introduced that song yourself on the new album, Back to My Roots.
This is a song my mother used to sing every evening after prayer when she took us on the front porch. I want to dedicate this one to Mama. We learned all of this from my mother. Every day we had to sing this song. She didn't let us rest until we sung this song. Oh, it's gonna rain and Bella's in mine. God sure knows about the rainbow sign.
The opening couple of verses there from It's Gonna Rain from Back to My Roots. And I can hear you laughing, Candy Staten, as you listen to it. That singing that with your sister Maggie's on that track with you.
Yeah, she's got the next verse.
Singing that with her and with the choir in behind you there, it must have just woken up memories of childhood. I presume lots of them very happy.
And it reminds me so much of her. I mean, she passed away in 1979. And that was her favorite, her favorite song. And that's one of my roots right there.
Was it a good lesson to be carrying around with you, "It's Gonna Rain," you know, to kind of...
It was a warning. Mm. It's actually a warning, you know, to tell people to get right with God, you know, because it's gonna rain. The first time it rained, it was in Noah's time, you know, it rained in the ark and all that stuff. But the next time it said it would be fire. So that means something altogether different. But she wanted, I just kept it in mind and I decided that we should do it on this Back to My Roots, because that is the roots.
Yeah. And
you, right
and
you, there, you the could, beginning of the roots.
Yeah. You really can hear that. You mentioned the Jewel Gospel Trio earlier on. I mean, you were 11 or 12, I think, when you first, you went off to school and it was a Christian school, the Jewel, was it called?
Yeah.
The Jewel Academy or the Jewel Gospel Christian Academy, I think was the correct title.
It was a Jewel Academy. We were the Jewel Gospel Trio. We were like, offsprings of the school. We were there to help other kids, less fortunate kids. We never made any money much, you know, but we met a lot of great people that helped to carry me to where I am today.
That was just
stepping stones. Yeah. And we did that with the Naomi Harrison. She was 9. I was 11. My sister was 13. And we all used to sing with Sam Cooke, where everybody would be on the show, and the tickets would be like $2. Auditoriums be filled to the brim. We were the only gospel group that had a band.
Wow.
Back in the day when we were in the 50s, no gospel group ever had a band. And we had a 5-piece band, the drums, the bass, the gospel steel, keyboards, and rhythm guitar. And 3 little girls singing their hearts out on stage. And we were a phenomenon. Nobody could. We had to end every show. We had to end it because they couldn't come behind us.
Wow.
Everybody else had like a guitar, organ, piano, but we had it all.
Big band, yeah. And had you any sense? I mean, that would have been around the time of the Mahalia Jackson stuff as well. You and Sam Cooke, as you mentioned, had you any sense as a young girl that you were with these legends of gospel and of soul music?
I used to admire them. We had a little radio. We had a little old, my daddy went out and found us a little radio, and we used to hear it on the gospel radio stations, and I adored these people. I wanted to be like these people. I would sing behind them, and I would sing behind Mahalia, and I would try to mock Mahalia. as she sung songs, and we would learn it, and we were just into it. And to meet them in person and become family with them was just beyond my wildest imagination. And I remember the first time I met Mahalia, I was peeking through a peephole in her dressing room. We were at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, Tennessee. And she said, Marion, her keyboard player, tapped me on the shoulder. I was a little girl. She said, "Do you want to meet her?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she opened the door, and Mahalia hugged me, and I thought I had just died and gone to heaven. Mahalia Jackson just hugged me. And she said, "Lovely. I heard about you. I'm going to watch you." And she said, "One of these days, I'm going to get me some of that music."
Well, she certainly did that. And thankfully, as you say, it was one of the stepping stones which brought you to other places within your career as well.
Yes.
That did finish up. You went back to Alabama. And it was a kind of change in the style of music. When you found yourself kind of being set up to sing the song "Young Hearts Run Free," did you feel you were in the same musical room as your gospel music, or did it feel as if you'd gone to a totally different planet?
Well, when you go to church and they tell you if you sing the blues, you're going to hell. So I had to work my way through that area to convince myself, no, I'm not going to hell. This is life. I named it life music. I told Al Green one time, he said, "What's wrong with my songs? They're not, I'm tired of being alone." "That's the truth." I said, "Well, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life." So it's life music.
Yep.
So you're not going nowhere. You're going wherever your heart goes. So I said, "No, we're not going to be guilty of that anymore." And that's what I really just let it all hang out.
Yeah. And
so I'm going to sing whatever I want to sing.
Yeah. And "Young Hearts Run Free" was one of the huge hits, the kind of big disco style hit, as we'll hear now in a moment. And we'll hear the story of how this actually fitted into, unfortunately, what was happening in your own life at the time. But let's have a listen to the song first. "Young Hearts Run Free" from Candy Sitton, who's with me on the programme this evening, talking about her new album, "Back to My Roots." "Young Hearts Run Free" is not on that album. But, you know, it's such an upbeat song, that, Candy. But when you listen to the lyrics of, particularly in the chorus.
Sad.
Yeah. And it was a sad time in your life.
It was I was in with this. I even hate to go back there. It's so dark, you know. But I was with this guy, and he was threatening to kill everybody in my family if I left him, because he was pimping me. And so, I was telling David Crawford, we were doing the first album with Warner Brothers. I had just left Fame Records at the time. Warner Brothers was looking for a producer, and I had just signed with them. And I had known David for many years, because he was with the Caravans in the gospel industry. So, we had talked about getting together and doing some music together. But to make a long story short, we would be sitting down. We've done some of the sides for the album. But we were sitting down eating lunch, and we would go to lunch quite often. And I would tell him what I was going through. I was just dumping. I was just, listening to somebody just in an open ears. I wanted to tell somebody what I was going through, because you can't talk to everybody. And so I told David, and I realized he was writing. He just kept writing down stuff, and he would look up at me and he would write it down. We would eat, and he would look up at me, and I would keep talking, and we would write it down. And he took that song, the words that I was saying to him, and made a song out of them.
Yeah.
And it came out, "Young Heart Run Free."
And when you were singing that song at that time, did it help you pluck up the courage to do what you had to do, which is to get out of that relationship and move on with your life? Did singing the song actually feed into that?
Oh, yes. Yes, it gave me courage. You know, I was with him at the time. And I would listen to it myself. And I said, I got to get rid of this man. I don't know how I'm going to do it. And nobody's going to get hurt. And I just figured out a way to get rid of him.
You did it.
I moved back to my mother's home. I went back to my roots.
Well, exactly as you have done here.
I left Virginia, where I was living, Reston, Virginia, and I built a house next to my mother's house, which I went back to my roots to get rid of him. And that's what got rid of him.
A story of resilience there from legendary soul singer Candy Staten, reflecting with Sean on Young Hearts Run Free and the moment in her life when she decided to truly begin again. You're listening to The Essential Sean Rocks here on RTE Radio 1. We're remembering our dear friend Sean by listening back to some of his best work. I'm Kieran Hines. Now, Fiona Shaw is a woman whose acting career has run the gamut of television, stage and film, often playing the most compelling and complicated women. And I should know, I've had the pleasure of working with her a couple of times, and she's a remarkable colleague. But let's listen now to her most recent chat with Sean about her role in the film Hot Milk, as Rose, an exiled Irish woman whose mysterious and impossible to diagnose illness confines her to a wheelchair.
What a woman this Rose character is, Fiona. You were on board, I think, from the very early stages. I can only imagine what attracted you to such a character. What did?
I'm always horrified at how horrified people are by Rose, because I actually like her very, very much. And I don't want to be her, and I'm not saying I want to meet her on a dark night, but I think that she is, you know, she's an amalgamation of troubledness and selfishness and difficulty and vulnerability and humour. And I think a lot of people are that.
Do you have to like her as the person playing her?
I do like her. I like her because she's selfish. I mean, I like playing her because she's selfish. Of course, if I was her daughter, I wouldn't like her necessarily. I'd find her very difficult. But I enjoyed the fact that she likes herself. I think that's what I like playing.
Yeah, that she actually does like herself. And I suppose that is one of the wonderful things about the character, Fiona, is this idea of pain. And is pain physiological? Is pain psychological? You know, the body can't hide. They always say the body will show, you know, any kind of trauma. Eventually it will come out in the body. Where did you land in terms of that balance between the physiological aspects of Rose's situation? She's in a wheelchair, and the psychological aspects, which we learn as the film goes on.
Well, we did research it, but I do feel that Rose's relationship to it is the thing that I'm playing. And Rose, A, feels the pain very physically, so she has pain. Two, it never crosses Rose's mind that it's neurological or psychological. So that's my job. You know, outside of that, you can see that it is, you know, a syndrome, and it is maybe based in trauma potentially, or there may be solutions for other people who have this syndrome, where they can walk and then they can't walk and then they can. They don't know why it comes back again, and they don't know why it comes back, and it disrupts families. So it's a very real thing, but it's not a diagnostic element. And here it's a metaphor for someone who is invisible to themselves, or is a mystery to herself. Yeah. So I don't have to come down on either side.
Yeah,
but it's certainly not made up. I don't think she would go to all this trouble just to pretend.
Yeah, and you play that, Fiona. I think you went to great lengths to get that aspect of portraying that physical pain and the difficulties of being in a wheelchair.
Yes, I stayed in the wheelchair all day, which was a pain in itself. But it's the least you can do. You know, you are kind of taking on somebody who is in profound suffering. And in a funny way, it's much easier to go with the thing entirely than to be jumping in and out of it. And it's not fair on the team who are making the film if you're offering them two versions of yourself all day. You must just offer them the character. So
I did wonder, I mean, one of your great stage roles, Winnie in Happy Days, who isn't in a wheelchair, but she is buried up to her waist and then up to her neck. Were there parallels? Because you don't have the use of the body in some ways with Winnie, certainly not visible to the audience. You do with Rose. The body is very visible to us.
Yes, and I'm very interested you should mention that, because when I was playing Winnie in Happy Days, who's buried up to her waist and up to her neck, I thought, gosh, this is very hard. And Roger Michell, who had been Samuel Beckett's assistant on the version that they'd done at the Royal Court, he said that Beckett had said to him, "I love Winnie. she's full of life, and it completely transformed my relationship to the play. And I thought of that a lot when I was playing. That it's not that I have to love her, but I love her because she is profoundly herself. And she's not, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't themselves, who go around sort of with hidden versions of prescribed versions or, you know, overly polite versions. Rose is uninhibited. And it's quite refreshing for her to be that person.
At what point along the way, I'm not sure if she is Irish in the novel, but by God, she's Irish in the film, that is for sure. I think she even says at one point along the way, Fiona, Asher and Grant in the way of an Irish mammy. How important was that aspect? And becomes much more serious later on. I don't want to go down into the detail of the psychology behind some of it, but it becomes very Irish in how the film is resolved and her pain is resolved for us.
Well, Rebecca, you know, rewrote the character in that way, or rewrote the history of the character in that way. In fact, the dynamics are probably very similar to the novel, but and that was really very, very good because it freed us from the novel and it stopped me trying to pretend to be from North Yorkshire that it just released us into something that I could connect with.
And the Irish mammy, Irish daughter aspect of things, there's a wonderful chemistry, at times loving, at times pretty nasty between the two of them, it has to be said, as well, between yourself and Emma Mackey playing that character of Sophia. How did you go about establishing that, or is that one of the happy accidents of making a film or doing a play?
We jumped into it because we met quite near the making of the film. We just had to start with a scene, a very, very big scene very early on in the shoot, which is the really big fight scene. And I think that was a very good thing because it made us know where we were going to get to. And so everything else, all the domestic scenes were in relation to this huge fight scene. And I think Emma was very game, and we just tried to find a mother-daughter relationship, which we did. But the idea of shame is very interesting, that it is in the end. I met a psychotherapist recently who said shame is really the bottom of everything. Revenge, everything, it's shame. And I think people ashamed who've hidden their shame, it makes a lot of sense of why they might be slightly off at the wrong angle in life.
Fiona Shaw there, talking with Sean about how she works and gets inside the head of her characters. Well, we're going to end the essential Sean Rocks with some beautiful music from the Sean Knows singer Irla O'Leonard. Irla has been a regular guest on Arena, and earlier this year he joined Sean to talk about Festival of Voice, a celebration of the power, beauty and universality of song. And Sean began by asking Irla about his collaboration with the conductor David Brophy.
I think you had worked with David previously on this set of arrangements by a lot of them contemporary composers of the Shandos song. It must have been a festival, or that must have been a project that worked really well for you.
Well, it was. It's some years ago now, but I always imagined that maybe these songs could exist in kind of a new context, because of course one of the great strengths of Irish song is the melodic kind of contour of our music. It's so beautiful, and I think the world over people comment on how beautiful the melodies are. So some time ago, I did reach out to a lot of I suppose you could call them contemporary classical composers. They normally don't do arrangements, but I called in a few favors and this and that. And I managed to get some beautiful arrangements made, and some of them will feature in this concert.
Yeah, and among the composers whose arrangements will feature, Donacha Dennehy, of course, you've collaborated with Donacha and Crash Ensemble on more than one occasion, for sure. Dan Truman is in there as well. And Nico Muley, a man who has worked with Bjork, Anthony and the Johnsons, and the Metropolitan Opera House in New York.
Right.
I mean, yeah, a very varied performance. I was interested in how he was speaking about this idea of when you go near these songs, you have to be very careful not to trample on them and to stand back and let the song sing.
Well, I suppose, in a way, I think sometimes people are too careful about that, especially when they're coming from the outside. They tend to, maybe there's a certain caution. I think Donogh Cadenhy, for example, is very brave.
Yeah.
I suppose he's very familiar with my singing and with the tradition. Dan Truman also has done a lot of work in folk music, various folk musics, particularly Norwegian Hardanger and so forth. His work with Cleaving O'Reilly and many other things. He spent many months working on the arrangements, came to visit me in my house and really dug in very deep. Nico is so talented and is so naturally musical. I had no fear but that he would do something beautiful. And it has a sort of an American bigness to it, kind of that Panavision sort of feel that American composers often have.
Yeah, and when you think of that alongside Shannos, they seem like the opposites in some ways, because you think of the Shannos song, you think of the single voice, the single line, very little beat or meter carrying it along, purely that melodic line. It seems like a much more intimate affair than that, as you say, this pan vision type of aspect that you get.
And it is, you know, for the most part. And you mentioned something very interesting there, the thing about the time. Because, you know, Shannos singers, well, I speak for myself. I'm very bad on matters of time when it comes to singing in time or for time.
Well, you're not
time.
Counting 1, 2, 3, 4 as you're singing these songs.
I don't think I would be able to do it comfortably were it not for the fact that the wonderful David Brophy will be at the helm, and was when I first did these. Because he, of course, is very experienced in working with opera and this notion of bringing the orchestra along with the blind man on the galloping horse, who happens to be me. At the time. But, he's the master. I follow him with an open heart and with gladness. Yes.
I want to listen to some of the music. And we've spoken a bit about Nico Muley there. An Huildore is the song that he has arranged. Did you kind of match song to composer, or how did you go about that?
I did to some extent, yes. For example, the ones that Dan Truman are doing, he had a particular interest in my singing of those songs. Donogh Cadenhy had used Tom Sheenter, the Huama, as part of the substrate, along with Aisling Gall, for his now famous composition, Grog's Boss. Yeah. So he was very familiar with that one, but we hadn't actually given it wings on its own. And I thought of Nico, I did think of the scale of An Huildore, with its sort of, there's a feel in the melody, I think, that it is expansive and it is hovering over the landscape. And it's full of that sort of rhetorical grandiosity describing the beautiful Irish landscape of the 19th century. So I don't know. I think he did his own thing with it, but I think it's what I wanted.
Let's have a listen. Just as we were listening to that, Éire Ólainard, that's a recording of An Huildore, an arrangement by Nico Muley. I think it's the RTE Concert Orchestra playing there. But we were saying, as we were listening to that little instrumental section, that's Aaron Copland. You know, it's those American composers that you're hearing, and suddenly the Shannos song and that beatless, meterless kind of quality fits perfectly into the open landscape.
I think so. I mean, even when I hear people like Keith Jarrett playing folk songs on piano, the Americans have a way of sort of opening it out into their own landscape, making sense of it in their own landscape, which is so beautiful and surprising. But then also it shows, I think, that our folk music is very adaptable, you know.
We were talking, what we were listening to, with great respect to Nico Muley, we were talking about Dan Truman and his arrangements. He does a version, which I have here, of he arranged Shula Roon for you. You know, beautiful song, perhaps with a little bit more meter in it than many's the song. You can hear a little bit more of a beat in this. But I wonder, particularly for Dan Truman and Nico Muhly, working with the Irish language, like Donegal would have a knowledge at least, or at least have heard the language and have gone through it at school. How did they react to the linguistic aspect of these songs?
Well, Dan Truman is very invested in that kind of area.
Mm.
What does the language offer musically? And I've worked with him. I've done an opera with him. I've done these songs with him and other things. I worked with him in Princeton for about 4 years. We did a lot of stuff there. He's super invested, to use an Americanism, in the sound of the language itself. And from the get-go, he was fascinated also with probably the hidden darknesses in this song. And I think he exposes and reveals a lot of interior emotional content in the song with these arrangements. That's one of the great advantages of working with an orchestra and with a great composer like Dan Truman, is that you find new and surprising avenues and information that you never thought the song contained.
But let's hear how it starts out and how we hear the very familiar strains of Shula Roon, the Dan Truman arrangement, Earl O'Leonard singing.
Irla O'Leonard there with Sean Rocks. Well, I want to thank you for joining me in this celebration of our friend Sean Rocks. I hope you've enjoyed hearing Sean's work again from Arena. Listening back, we're reminded not only of the artist Sean championed, but of the singular way he connected with people as a broadcaster and as a friend. He's greatly missed and warmly remembered. I leave you now with a live performance that Irla O'Leonard did for Arena on Culture Night in Studio One in September in remembrance of Sean Rocks.
Chwyr y cnig ys y sleiti I bort y chele Chwyr ein i yn tiel sio Helefon yr stwyr Bont yn e'r chlis Gwys
You're listening to Arena.